Blog Talk Radio.
An associate real estate broker with Long and Foster, and I'm here with my husband, Jawanza, my favorite co-host.
Thank you so much. Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to spend it with us. We don't take you for granted. You could be doing anything, but you've taken time out to tune in and to be our special guest as well. We've got another special guest lined up for you, and we consider you our guest as well, so thank you so much.
Thank you again. Yes, thank you for tuning in, and we are so excited about bringing you another broadcast on renovation loans. But tonight, our special guest will be covering real estate, renovation loans for real estate investors. So those of you that have been thinking about investing in real estate, we're going to go over some of the different basic information that you need to know concerning renovation loans and basically how to get started.
You know, I'm excited about this show. This is really exciting information. We're living in an exciting time in terms of real estate, and just this information is really exciting because, I mean, when you get an opportunity, as I always say, to sit and listen to people that know what they're talking about, because there are a lot of people out here that don't know what they're talking about. So when you have an opportunity to learn, to sit and learn and glean and, you know, grow intellectually just from people that know their stuff,
absolutely,
then that can really make the difference if you're talking about, delving into real estate and, any venture. It's very important to have information, the right information, and to be able to talk to people that know is always a great blessing.
Absolutely. And last week we had our special guest, Richard Day, who is a loan officer and home renovation specialist with Assurance Financial Group. Richard was with us last week, mm-hmm. and he really talked about and helped us to understand renovation loans for first-time home buyers, mm-hmm. or owner-occupants.
Right.
And so that's why we wanted Richard to come back tonight, and Richard has agreed to come back, and he's now going to share and give us more information now, again, as we mentioned, about renovation loans for investors. Richard, we are so happy that you were able to come back tonight, and we are excited about this show. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure, and very excited to do it.
Well, for those that's just listening in for the first time, remember to go back and listen to the show last week. But, Richard, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got started, for those that are just tuning in tonight?
Yeah, sure. I've been a mortgage lender since 1988. And in 1991, when I was living in Baltimore City, one of my realtors called me and asked me if I knew what a 203K loan was, which is a particular renovation product that's available today still. And it kind of took off from there. So since 91, I've done over 2,000 renovation loans for owner-occupants, investors, and even second home borrowers. I teach CE classes on renovation lending. And I've done 4 renovation loans personally as a borrower. So I have that unique experience of being on both sides of the transaction. And I love it. I love old houses, and it's very exciting stuff.
You know, in the market today, there are just, you know, you really have to be creative for those of us that are real estate agents. I mean, it's a seller's market. The inventory is low, and sometimes for buyers, and well, many times today in the market, it's kind of you run into these multiple offer type of situations. So we talked about it last week, how you have to be creative and you have to think of various options as far as even to be able to purchase properties as is, a lot of people even are thinking about new construction, and then they, if they're not able to purchase new construction, then they are, they have to look at other options. And so that's why last week we talked about renovation loans for first-time home buyers. But definitely when you are thinking about becoming a real estate investor, that's definitely something that you have to think about. How do I fix up this property? Because as an investor, it is your, you are thinking profit-driven.
And I think it's important for people, for our listeners, to understand the difference between an investor and a first-time home buyer. I mean, you know, when they hear people hear the first, you know, hear the term first-time home buyer, it sounds self-explanatory, but it might not be as self-explanatory as it sounds. So, Richard, if you don't mind, for our listeners, could you define the difference between a first-time home buyer and an investor? I mean, it really seems like for a lot of people they might feel like that's real self-explanatory, but a lot of people might not know.
Sure. So the lending industry differentiates borrowers into basically three classifications. Owner-occupants, meaning somebody who will buy a house, take out a mortgage, and live in the house. Vacation or second home borrowers, people that will buy the house, not rent it out, and use it, you know, periodically throughout the year as a second home, often in a like a resort location or the mountains or the beach or in the country or whatever. And then the third option, which we're going to talk about a lot this evening, is non-occupant borrowers or investors, anyone who is buying a house, wants to take a mortgage out on it, and is not going to live there. Now, I get this question a lot. People get confused about somebody who's going to rent versus somebody who's going to renovate and flip. And from a lender's perspective, those buyers are the same. The common denominator is they're not going to live in the home. And if they're not going to live in the home, then it's an investor transaction. Whether they're going to keep it and rent it or they're going to flip it does not matter really to the lender. There is a minor detail that we'll talk about in a bit, but the main thing is they're not going to live in the property. And if they're not going to live in the property, they are an investor. And they will be treated as such when they go to take out a mortgage.
Okay, so last week you mentioned also, we talked about FHA 203K, and that is a renovation loan specifically for someone that is planning to occupy, live in the property.
Correct.
What were some of the other loans that you mentioned concerning if you're an owner-occupant? And the reason why I'm asking that is because, for instance, if a person currently owns a property and they're thinking about purchasing another property, or they're thinking about becoming a real estate investor, which means they're thinking about owning more than one property, I just want them to understand, you know, what is the difference, you know, what kind of is the difference between one renovation loan compared to a renovation loan for an investor. So if you could just briefly just share some of the renovation loans for owner-occupants.
So the easiest way to explain that is just because the menu of renovation products is fairly short. So let me just list them all, and then only two of them are really available for investors. So you have FHA 203K, VA renovation, USDA renovation, and then Fannie Mae Home Style and Freddie Mac Choice. So those are the five main renovation products in the marketplace. And the first three are for owner-occupants only, and the second two, the Fannie and Freddie products, are for owner-occupants and investors and second home borrowers. So for the investor market, they would be looking specifically at the Fannie Mae and the Freddie Mac products, Home Style and Choice.
Okay, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Home Style and Choice. Okay.
And did the VA stand for, was that for veterans?
Yeah, the VA is the veteran VA loan or Veterans Administration loan, and they have a renovation product. It is currently on a moratorium right now because of they did that as part of the pandemic. But hopefully, I'm hoping that maybe late spring or early summer it'll be back available again.
Okay. And it was one question from last week that I did not ask, which segues into, I think, even also talking about investment properties. Can a first-time home buyer purchase a multifamily home, like a duplex, quad, and still be considered an investor if they are leasing one or two of the units? They're living in one unit, but they are leasing.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up at some point. I'm glad you brought it up ahead of me. So if a buyer of a property buys a 2, 3, or 4 family, and the most units they can do under all of these programs is 4 units. If a buyer buys a property that is more than a single family home, 2, 3, or 4 unit, and they live in one of the units, the transaction is considered owner-occupied because they're living in one of the units. So even though they get investment income from the other units, the other non-occupant units, it's still considered an owner-occupied transaction. Now, they can buy a multi-unit property, especially under FHA, as an owner-occupant, up to 4 units, and they can still put as little as the minimum down, which is 3.5%, which is incredible. So let me just paint a little picture for you, for the listeners. The single family loan limit for the Central Virginia, Richmond MSA is $535,900. Excuse me. A 2 unit, the loan limit is, I don't know exactly what it is off the top of my head, but it's something like the low 700s or the high 600s. For a 3 unit, the loan limit goes up to like 850. And for a 4 unit, the loan limit is just a hair over $1 million. So think about this. A person could buy a property, whether they're renovating or not, doesn't matter, but let's say they're renovating because that's what I prefer. they could buy $1 million home that has 4 apartments, and as long as they live in one, they can put 3.5% down.
Wow.
And have rental income from the other 3 units or 2 units or whatever. So that's a largely probably unknown thing by most realtors, and probably a lot of lenders don't even know that. And to me, that's an amazing opportunity.
That is an amazing opportunity because income that you're receiving from the other units can actually pay your note and you can be living there free.
Absolutely. And I've done loans where people have had that situation. Now I'm going to throw one more curveball in here for everybody. And this is something that almost nobody knows, including most lenders. And it's I think it's one of the best kept secrets about FHA 2 or 3K. Is that FHA 2 or 3K, again, as long as the buyer lives in one of the units, can even buy a mixed-use property. So let's say, for example, a neighborhood like Jackson Ward or The Fan or Churchill, one of these neighborhoods, you have, townhouse structures. And so let's say somebody buys a building in Jackson Ward and it has 3 stories, and the first story is a convenience store or a dry cleaner or an office, and on the second and third floor are 2 apartments. Somebody using a 2 or 3K could buy that, do a renovation loan on it, or if it was turnkey, just do a regular FHA loan on it. And I'm sorry. I was about to misspeak there. This is only for 2 or 3K. It's not allowed on 2 or 3B. This is a loophole for renovation only. So somebody could buy that building, the three-story building, commercial first floor, apartment second floor, apartment third floor, live in one of the 2 apartments, do a renovation loan, and put 3.5% down, and possibly even count some of the commercial rent towards their qualifying ability, and definitely count the rent from the other unit towards their qualifying ability. And FHA, that's a rule that's been on the books for decades. And I've done probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 dozen loans under 2 or 3K with mixed-use properties over the years. But it's an incredible opportunity. And speaking of, I know we talked about first-time homebuyers last week, but imagine a first-time homebuyer doing something like that, buying a 4-unit or buying a 4-unit with a commercial space or a 2-unit with a commercial space, buying that property and having that income stream, and then, you know, 4 years down the road, keeping that property and then buying another house. They, in effect, convert themselves into an investor and have this amazing income-producing property.
Wow. Well, how does this work, Richard, in this regard? Because you might have a situation where somebody is looking to buy a mixed-use property, and, you know, let's say they have a business on the first floor. You know, they live on the second floor and they're renting out the third, but they haven't bought it yet. So they don't have the tenant in the, let's say they don't have the tenant in the upstairs, you know, unit. So
yeah,
how can
yes.
they calculate
yeah, so the loan guidelines, yeah, the loan guidelines, they use what's called a vacancy factor. It's 25% of the projected rent. So let's say they get $1,000 from the apartment on the third floor and they get, you know, $2,000 from the commercial space. That's $3,000 worth of income. The lenders will discount that $3,000 by 25%, and whatever's left, the 75% of projected gross rental income, can be used towards their qualifying ability to carry the mortgage note.
Oh, okay. Wow. Interesting.
They can, and so you said that a part of that income can be used to help qualify for the actual purchase. And is that because whether a tenant is there or not there? Is that?
Well, no. Whether a tenant's there or not doesn't matter. It's projected. So you imagine they're buying the property to fix it up. So let's say two scenarios. One is that the apartments are not habitable because it's in such disrepair. So we just use whatever the appraiser says the projected rent will be. Or let's say that there's a tenant there now, but when the buyer buys the house, they're going to let that tenant's lease expire and get them out, and then they're going to fix up that apartment, and then they'll get more rent. So either way, I mean, we'll use projected rent, or if there's a tenant there, we'll use 75% of the current lease. But I would say, based on my experience, in most cases, it's projected rent, because most of the time the buyer is renovating the apartments anyway.
Okay, right there, just that information right there, if you just heard that,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's fantastic, especially it could be someone, a college student or someone maybe that just graduated or someone just, you know, that's able to, you know, they just want to be able to just go in and just occupy one of the properties and then, like you said, and fix up the remaining properties and use that FHA 203K. That is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
So, Richard, we also wanted to, if a buyer does not plan to occupy the property, so that definitely would be considered an investment property, because now in this particular situation, same scenario except you're not occupying one of the units. So how does that work?
That is correct. Yeah, so this is where, I've still got some good news, but there's a little bit of bad news, and this is, I don't know why the rules are the way they are, but they are. I don't write the rules. So let's just talk about renovation loan for investors in general. So as we said, for owner-occupant, FHA, 203K, it's 3.5% down. For conventional, Fannie and Freddie, single family, the minimum down payment is 15%. So let's say they buy a property for $150,000 and they borrow $50,000 for renovation, so the acquisition cost is $200,000. 15% of the $200,000 would be $30,000 down. So that would be the down payment on a single-family investment renovation transaction. Now, conventional underwriting guidelines, Fannie and Freddie, do allow investors to purchase 2, 3, and 4-unit properties as well, but they only allow single family on renovation, which is really unfortunate, but that is their rule.
So,
just like an owner occupant, we can use 75% of projected rent for that single family dwelling towards their qualifying ability. And unless the investor has, you know, a lot of liquid capital, or let's say they have liquid capital and they don't want to part with it, then a renovation loan could be a good tool for them. Because think about this: if they bought that house for $150,000, they'd have to, let's say it's in bad shape, or bad enough shape it won't pass an appraisal, they're going to have trouble finding financing to begin with. So their only option might be paying cash. And maybe they have enough cash to buy the house, but they don't have enough cash to buy the house and renovate it, then a renovation loan would be an attractive option for that particular investor.
Okay. All right. So what if now, so this person now wants to purchase a particular property in this particular scenario that you just used, and they need to put or have available $30,000, they have to put, well, at closing, they have to be able to bring not only the down payment but also the closing costs as well.
Correct.
Okay, and then in addition to that, if it's not a single family, as you mentioned, they have to have the cash to do the renovation.
If it's a single family, we'll lend them the renovation money, but they have to put 15% down of the total acquisition cost. So again, if the sales price is $150,000 and the renovation's $50,000, they'll go to closing, they'll bring 15% of the $200,000, the total number. They'll bring that $30,000 will go to the seller as part of the down payment and part of the sales price, and 100% of the renovation money will be held in escrow by the lender and then paid out to the contractor as the renovations are completed.
Okay. So you were referring to multifamily. In the case of a multifamily, it works differently as far as...
Renovation on conventional loans for investors is only available for single-family homes. When it comes to multifamily, they have to be in move-in condition. They don't have to be, you know, the Taj Mahal, but they do have to be in move-in condition. They just, for whatever reason, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have not extended multi-unit properties to investors. And that could change someday, but thus far they have not done it.
And just so that the listeners are clear, when is the appraisal done on the renovation loan, or when, you know, during that deal? At what point is the renovation done? Would it be... Of course, well, after, you know, let's say after the renovations have been done, is the appraiser going to come out and say, okay, well, it's been brought up to this particular standard, or is it done prior to the renovations?
Yeah, so let's go over what we did last week for tonight's audience, what I call the five steps of a renovation loan. So, you know, buyer gets a contract, you have a buyer that has a contract, the seller and the buyer have agreed on a price. So step one with me as a lender is, and by the way, this information is at my website, which is fixandfinance.com. If you go to fixandfinance.com and go to the consultation tab, these five steps are listed there. So step one is apply for the loan. Applying for a renovation loan is no different than applying for a regular mortgage. It is a mortgage, so, you know, W-2s and tax returns and all that kind of stuff is pretty much the norm. Step two is get a contractor bid from a licensed and insured contractor of the buyer's choosing. Step three is we order the appraisal, and the appraiser uses that bid when they go to inspect the property, and they essentially envision the finished renovated home, and then they, you know, come up with a value based on, once those renovations are done, this is what the house will be worth. So they're envisioning the renovated house already completed, even though it's not. And then step four is what I call project management, where we validate the credentials of the contractor. And then step five is close and renovate. So once the loan's approved, the bid is final, the appraisal is complete, and the contract has been approved or validated, then the loan goes to closing. The seller is paid. The realtors are paid. You'll be happy about that. And 100% of the approved renovation budget is set up in an escrow account. And the day after closing, the contractor and the borrower can start doing the work on the house, or really the contractor can start doing the work on the house. And then as they complete phases of the work, we will pay that contractor in draws periodically based on whatever's been complete. And then once the project is completely done, then the final inspection's done, the contractor gets their last check, and the owner, the investor, now has their newly renovated home, and they can rent it or they can turn around and put it on the market and sell it. It's totally up to them.
Great information. So there's not going to be anybody, just everybody that's listening, there will be no excess. So, for example, if you, you know, think you're going to, you know, renovate the home and then, you know, let's say, for example, you know, go out and, you know, instead of, you know, getting top-notch materials and using top-notch people to bring it up to a particular thing and think that, okay, well, there'll be 25 grand left over and that'll be mine, it doesn't work like that. Okay, so.
No. Yeah, the dangling carrot for the – first of all, it's really, really unusual to see a project come in under budget. In fact, usually it's the opposite, as you might imagine. The draw for the investor typically is either the rental income, the built-in equity, or both. So let's go back to the example we've been using, $150,000 sales price, $50,000 in renovation. And if they got a good deal on the property to begin with, which hopefully they did, the property might appraise for, you know, 220 instead of just 200. Or it might be in such a strong rental market that they can rent it and cover their mortgage note. And, you know, let's say the mortgage payment's, you know, $1,200 a month, but they can rent it for $1,600 a month. So they're cash positive $400 a month. So really, it's one of those two. And then another thing that I think might have touched on last week, or maybe not, is, and this is a huge thing for both owner-occupants and investors, is historic tax credits. Did we talk about that last week?
You did. You touched on it a little bit, yeah.
But you can, I mean, for those who weren't here for last week's show, please, if you'd like to pick that up.
Yeah. Absolutely, because this can be, I know for a fact that some investors have done renovation projects, especially in like big developments, you know, big apartment buildings and things, which, you know, we're not talking about that tonight, but the point being is that I've seen investors or developers go in and buy huge parcels of properties, renovate them solely based on what they will get in the form of tax credits. In other words, the tax credits are the profit. So for a smaller transaction, like we're talking about right now in this example, the tax credits might only end up being, you know, $15,000. But in addition to some built-in equity, that's another $15,000 that you weren't banking on. So tax credits can be another incentive for investors to buy and renovate properties. And now they do – to fully reap the benefit of those, they do need to keep the property for, I think it's 5 years. But if the listeners go to DHR, which is the Virginia Department of Historic Resources, all those guidelines are at their website.
Now, is that normally associated with certain areas, like revitalization areas that you can, that those tax, maybe I'm thinking about tax abatement.
Well, no, you're probably thinking about enterprise zones. So enterprise zones is another thing. That's another another animal, but that's certainly pertinent sometimes. So this is the simplest way to convey this to the audience tonight is if you're buying a property to renovate and rent or renovate and sell, one thing you should always look at is the property in a historic district? Because if it is, that opens up the possibility to apply for historic tax credits. Doesn't mean you have to, but you might want to. And secondly, is the property in a enterprise zone? There's another label another zone that I'm forgetting about, and it was part of the 2018 tax bill that was put into law. I want to say revitalization is in the word, but I would just, anybody listening, I would just, you know, Google 2018 tax bill real estate investment incentives, and I'm sure it'll probably come right up. But so that, I think, is the revitalization rule that was put in that tax bill is pretty much automatic for most investors, based on if the property is in an enterprise zone or one of those designated zones. Enterprise zones are generally more commercial related, so that's going to be a little thinner to find. And of course, historic tax credit, historic neighborhoods rather, around Richmond and Central Virginia, there's several of them. So you can go to, like in the city of Richmond, you can go to the Architectural Review Board, and they've got a map of all the historic districts in the city, and you can print it out and look for properties in those specific neighborhoods if you're interested mm-hmm. in a tax credit project. And remember, the more renovation you do, the more tax credit you get. So let's take that scenario. Instead of $150,000 in sales price and $50,000 in renovation, let's say $50,000 in sales price and $150,000 in renovation. Now, instead of only $12,000 or $15,000 in tax credits, now you're talking about like $35,000, $37,000 in tax credits.
Wow.
So that would offset even the slightly higher interest rate than when you factor in the tax credits, correct?
Well, not so much that, but it helps you. It increases the benefit of buying and investing in real estate. It's another benefit that if tax credits didn't exist, that's $37,000 you wouldn't have access to. In that example,
right.
So you know Don't leave. The bottom line is don't leave money on the table. Make sure that if you're an investor, you should know all these things so you can go into transactions with eyes wide open and take advantage of every possible benefit that's out there.
Speaking of interest rates, is the interest rate or would the interest rate be higher for an investor as opposed to first-time home buyer? I mean, and I mentioned that in my last comment because I was thinking about renovation loans. If I'm not mistaken, in the last show you mentioned that they tend to be just – I was speaking of the renovation loans in general having a little higher interest rate than a regular commercial or a conventional loan. But in this particular instance, when it comes to an investor versus a first-time home buyer, would the interest rate vary on the higher side?
As it relates to renovation.
Yeah. So renovation rates are a little bit higher than non-renovation rates or regular mortgage rates. And then when you add the investor portion to it, there's another bump on the rate. So an investor renovation rate will probably run, you know, 0.625% higher than regular rates, regular owner-occupant rates at the time. But for most investors, it's still cheap money because – the alternatives are often way more expensive, you know, like hard money loans. We're not going to really talk about those because I don't do those, but hard money loans, you know, those rates can be, you know, in the teens. So obviously, you know, even 4% compared to 13% is way, way better. And then commercial loans by local and regional banks also tend to run on the high side. The bottom line is investor loans are riskier loans for any lender, and that's just a statistical fact. And because they're riskier, meaning they go to foreclosure more often, the rates are adjusted a little bit higher.
You know, what's interesting, Richard, about that is that if I'm not mistaken, that even when it comes to, and please correct me if I'm wrong, even when it comes to the lending guidelines for investors that, you know, they ask for more, you know, not more documentation, but you have to have more skin in the game. For example, you may have to have 6 months, if that's the number, worth of mortgage payments.
Payment reserves, yeah. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, payment reserves, more money down and higher rates, and all of those are driven by the fact that investors go to foreclosure historically about 3 to 4 times as often as owner-occupants. And that is the only reason that investor loans are have more rigid guidelines and more and bigger down payments. If it was the other way around, then investor rates and down payments would probably be lower, and our occupant rates would be and down payments would be higher, but that's not the case. And a lot of people are surprised when they hear that because they assume that investors outperform owner occupants. But too many investors, I think, go into this, and I think this is really important to mention. Too many investors go into real estate investing, you know, with, you know, sort of these glamorous ideas of owning a bunch of properties and becoming a, you know, wealthy on real estate. And at the end of the day, and you both know this, real estate investing is hard work. It's not a walk in the park. It's work. It's another job. And so you've got to go in and you've got to, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's and keep an eye on your money and keep an eye on the contractors and make sure that you market the properties well and make sure your tenants stay, you know, you make sure that your units stay occupied so you don't lose, you know, you don't have a lot of rental lost months where you're not renting units. It's work. I mean, it can be beneficial, absolutely, but it's still work. So
that's the reason why, you know, tonight's show, we're actually talking about the ways and the opportunity to be able to enter into the field of real estate investing. But definitely there's a lot more information. There's a lot of things that you have to take in consideration. And, you know, Richard, you're sharing with us the aspect of some ways of financing this investment. But you're definitely, you have to have a team. You have to know the tax advantages, because the whole purpose is to be profitable. And whether you're holding on to the property, whether you're flipping the property, you can lose a lot of money if you make the wrong decision. And
correct.
So that's why
absolutely
we're educating you. We're offering this information to our listeners and to just help give you an opportunity to just, you know, begin to learn more about real estate investing. But definitely it's a career, it's a job, it's something you definitely have to, you know, understand the ins and outs, because you don't want to lose your money. Just like when you purchase a property, owner-occupant property, you want to know how to manage, take care of it, and build equity. And so it's a lot of things that you need to be able to understand about real estate investing as well.
Let's give the listeners an opportunity to check in. If you're listening by phone and you have a question for Richard, you better get him while you can. The call-in number is 515-605-9859. Again, that's 515-605-9859. My name is Juwanza.
And I am Yvette. And
our special guest is?
Our special guest is Richard Day with Assurance Financial Group. And Richard, you know, I forgot to ask this question last week, and I thought about it, and I said, you know, what about investing in land? Or if there's a particular property that needs a lot of work, and so, it, you know, after doing your, getting your bids and different things like that, it might be actually better to tear that property down, to demolish that property, to actually rebuild another house on that property. Is that something that you can still do with this type of, if you want to build a home on land?
Where there's no existing structure, you mean?
Where it can be an existing structure, or if there's not a structure, how does that work?
Yeah, so that's really a great question, because a lot of people get confused by them. So a parcel that has never had a house on it is just raw dirt. That is going to be a construction loan, not a renovation loan. Conversely, a parcel that has it could be a completely dilapidated structure that's about to fall in on itself, that can be a renovation loan. Now, there a lot of lenders will do a construction loan on a tear down and rebuild. That can be done under construction to perm lending. But for renovation, for a renovation loan, there has to be a property there to tear down and or rebuild to qualify for a quote-unquote renovation loan. But if it's a raw dirt, then, yeah, it would be a construction loan, and that is we can save that for another call another day if you want.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, and I thought about that, and I said, you know, because there's a lot of property, sometimes they actually look like they need to be torn down and just rebuilt.
Sometimes they do. I mean, it is what it is. I'm always a fan of trying to save a property, but, you know, some properties are so far gone, you know, you have no choice. They've got to be torn down and rebuilt.
Okay, that's great. I mean, we're learning a lot of information, and you know, I also, Juwanza mentioned that savings, okay, that when it comes to purchasing of an investment property and having money saved. Say, for instance, I like to use examples. Say, for instance, a person has already owns a home and now they want to purchase another property, not necessarily that they want to sell the property that they're in and purchase another property, but they want to hold on to their owner-occupant property and purchase another property. And so we're still talking about that down payment. You still have to have, if it's a single-family home, you still have to put 15% down for the renovation. Is that, but that's the requirement for the down payment. Is that
right.
Correct, Richard?
Yeah,
now,
that is correct. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, are you also required to have a certain amount saved for your current residence mortgage payments, as well as a certain amount
for the investment property?
For the investment property, since you're planning to put a tenant in the property.
You know, honestly, I don't know all the reserve requirements off the top of my head, but as I recall, there's not if you own your primary residence and you're buying your first investment property, they typically want to see, you know, like I think in the guidelines, either 2 or 3 months of payment reserves. But hypothetically, let's say that you have, this is your second investment property, so you have one owner occupied, one rental, and now you're buying another investment property, then you have to have 3 to 6 months reserves on the investment property you already have. So your reserve requirements start to build up the more property you have, and that can be financially burdensome for some borrowers. But I do want to throw one thing in here real quick, because I think this will be helpful for a lot of first-time investors especially, is I get this question fairly often, you know, can I borrow my cash to close? Can I borrow my down payment and my closing cost? And the short answer is no, and that applies for owner-occupants and investors. But what you can do, you can borrow your cash needed to close, down payment and closing cost, if it's borrowed against another piece of real estate. So, Yvette, using your example, somebody owns their own home they live in and they want to buy their first investment property, and we'll use the same numbers we used earlier. So it's 150 sales price, 50,000 renovation, 15% down of the 200,000 would be 30,000 down, and they've only got $10,000 in the bank. So they're like, oh, where are we going to get the rest of the money? If they happen to have, you know, let's say they have $70,000 of built-in equity in their current home, they could tap into that equity and borrow against the equity in their owner-occupied property and use that to accumulate the rest of their cash to close on that first investment property. And I've had lots of borrowers do that over the years.
Okay.
So you're using the equity you already have to acquire that first investment property, or even that second or third investment property.
Okay. So I guess that's a strategy as well, as you're building equity. Some people, you know, may not want to necessarily borrow from their residence, but for the purpose of reinvesting it into another property, you're really not losing. You're just reinvesting. You're taking it from one property and putting it into another property so that you'll be able to continue to, I guess, especially if you want to continue to build and purchase investment property. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, you're taking equity out of your primary residence, and that down payment is just more equity in the rental property. The one underlying benefit is if you rent it, you're now going to have rental income to add to your gross monthly income.
So that's the way. I mean, that's definitely one particular scenario. So, Richard, what about another scenario in which now the person wants to sell that primary residence and now maybe purchase another property, owner-occupant? Now they can also take advantage, again, back to that FHA 203K and purchase another property and lease out their primary residence. Is that, and how does that work? Is that the same?
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. As long as they're going to live in the property they're buying. Now, let me qualify that, because that's a scenario I've dealt with time and time again over the years. And the one thing that they want to guard against is, let's say the property they're vacating, it's called the property being vacated, but they're keeping, they're retaining it. Let's say that is a 3,500 square foot house and it's worth $500,000. And the subject property that they're buying, that they're going to move into, is a $150,000 house, and it's only 1,000 square feet. Most likely, an underwriter, no matter who the lender is going to be like, wait a minute. You're leaving that really big, nice house in this neighborhood, and you're moving out of that, and you're going to rent that, and you're going to live in this much smaller house in maybe a less desirable neighborhood that has way less space. You're really going to do that? Now, I have seen, and this is absolutely true, I have seen where the house they're vacating, what they're really doing is they're downsizing.
Yes, I was going to mention that.
And that property happens to be in a really good rental market, and there is a compelling reason to keep it. But that is usually not the case. Usually, they're keeping the smaller house, and they're buying the bigger house to live in. They're moving out of a 1,200-square-foot house, and they're moving into a 3,000-square-foot house. And that's a more realistic and a more logical scenario.
Okay.
But yes, they could do that, and they could do any owner-occupied property. It could be, I mean, program. They could do Fannie, Freddie, FHA, VHDA, USDA. I mean, whatever they're eligible for as an owner-occupant, they can do.
From a lender's perspective, what would be a bad loan? Just so that, you know, people understand that when they're applying for a loan, they have to keep in mind they can't just look at it from the standpoint of, oh, I want to borrow X amount, but they have to look at it from a lender's perspective too. And, you know, there are certain loans that lenders just will not do. What would be some of those loans? Why would not a lender, you know, give a person money? What would be considered a bad loan from a lender's point of view?
Their inability to pay the loan back would be the first one. Things that disqualify borrowers would be, you know, qualifying ratios are too high. They don't have enough money to close, credit score is too low, they have a bankruptcy or a foreclosure that's too new, too recent, they've changed jobs too many times, they haven't been self-employed long enough. I could go on and on.
Would be, for example, you know, maybe somebody that has experienced foreclosure? You mentioned too recent, because let's say, for example, they just came out of bankruptcy, and it's, I don't know if the what the guidelines are, it might be if you've been out for 2 years or, you know, five, depending on which chapter they filed or whatever. They might feel like, well, I've been out here. I mean, come on. Everything else, all other things being equal, will they substitute one criteria for another and say, okay, well, normally we wouldn't, but, you know, you've been on your job for 15 years, you know, that type of thing?
Unfortunately, no. It's funny. It used to be that way, especially before the mortgage meltdown. But there's always been some kind of guidelines on bankruptcies and foreclosures and so forth. The general rule is bankruptcy for Chapter 7, Chapter 11, you know, liquidation plans, They need to be out of it for at least a year, but in most cases, 2 years. For a foreclosure, it has to be at least 3 years old and in some cases, 7 years old. So foreclosures are the most damaging as far as hindering a buyer's ability to get another mortgage, especially as an investor. But bankruptcies are also can hamper their ability to borrow. So, you know, the bottom line is, you know, common sense, don't overextend yourself so that you're put in that situation, pay your bills on time, save money, you know, do all those things as best you can. Now, obviously, things happen that are beyond a person's control, you know, it could be a catastrophic illness, it could be, you know, their factory got shut down and they can't get another job in that marketplace. You know, lots of things happen that, you know, people get broadsided, and that's very, very unfortunate. But unfortunately, the rules are the rules, and they're guided by loan performance and statistical data. So they know that, like, borrowers that have been out of bankruptcy for at least 3 years, or rather 2 years, perform better than somebody who's been out of a bankruptcy for only 4 months. So, you know, all these rules are guided by lots and lots of past performance data. And is it always fair? No, it's not always fair. But, you know, those are the rules, and we have to work within those rules. One really important thing, this probably actually was not a question you all had, but I think it's important for the listeners to know. So there is a separate set of rules for investors as far as the number of loans they can have under conventional guidelines, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac guidelines. And I think this is really important for the audience to know. To put it as simply as I can, for non-renovation, there's up to 10 slots. For renovation, there's only 4 slots. And let me break that down. So if an investor... if somebody said, say, John Doe owns their primary residence and they own 5 rental properties, so they own 6 properties total, they could go acquire 4 more investment properties and get 4 more conventional mortgages before they would no longer be able to utilize Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac money. So they can have up to 10 mortgages under Fannie Freddie guidelines total, non-renovation, move-in condition homes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. For renovation, there's only 4 slots. So let's say Susie Smith owns her primary residence. She owns 1 investment property. So that's 2 slots taken. They could take out 2 more mortgages using renovation loans, but that's the most they could take out under Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac guidelines. Now, neither one of these rules means that they can't go get, like, private loans, you know, portfolio loans from banks and so forth, but they could not get secondary market Fannie Freddie loans beyond those 2 parameters.
Okay.
So does that make sense?
So they could have 6 properties and then 6 properties with the non-renovation and 4 renovation.
Well, no, they could have up to 10 non-renovation, but they can only have 4 using renovation. So the bottom line is one of the things I was –
So you
no, 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 no,
with...
no. It's no. It's 10 total. So let's say somebody buys a property, they could do their first 3 investment properties renovation, and then they'd be capped at the 4, but then they could do 6 more non-renovation. It's 10 total no matter what, but it's 4 only for renovation. So the message I would say is do the renovation loans first because if you do the – regular loans first, you're already going to surpass that 4 slot limit, and then you have no room to do any renovation.
And those renovation loans probably will provide you with the most equity if you do it right.
If you do it right, absolutely.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I would think. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I would agree.
It was something else I just was going to, oh, I know. I wanted to ask you about flipping a property. What are the guidelines when it comes to you want to use a renovation loan and you know you're going to flip that property?
I'm so glad you asked that because I almost forgot to bring it up, and I thought about it at the intro of the show tonight. That is a really, really important question. So whenever somebody calls me and they say, hey, I want to do a renovation loan and I'm going to flip it, there are what are called early payoff penalties that are a penalty to the lender, not the borrower, not the investor, to the lender. And the way those penalties work is, let's say, Yvette, you apply for a loan with me as an investor. You buy the property for $100,000. You borrow $25,000 to renovate. Let's say you buy the house. You wrote a contract on January 1st of this year. I close the loan at the end of February, and you do the renovation in 30 days. All right, so you're 90 days in, and you put it on the market. If you sell that property and you pay off the mortgage in less than 210 days, every dollar that I made as a commission and my branch made as the branch for the company, every dollar we made, we have to pay back to the investor, to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. So if an investor calls me and they say, I'm going to flip, I say to them, I will only do the loan for you if you promise me you will not close on the sale and pay off the loan in less than 210 days. Now, in most cases, what's that?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Is that because of interest or potential interest earned on the loan?
You know, honestly, I don't know what it's rooted in, but I'm sure that has something to do with it. But in most cases, it's usually not a big issue. So let's say we'll go back to the scenario: bought the house on January 1st. 210 days is going to be around 6 months, is June, so about say July 8th, you know, roughly. July 6th, July 8th, something like that. So let's say you buy, you close on the mortgage on January 1st, but let's say that it's $100,000 in renovation, all right? And, you know, the renovation takes 4 months. So now, January, February, March, April, so it's end of April, beginning of May, if the renovations are even complete, and then you put it on the market, you know, first week or two of May, and you get an offer in a week. So let's say you get an offer by May 20th. July 8th is less than 45 days away, and that's a fairly average turn time for a loan to close anyway. So that's not going to be difficult for you to hold off and say to the buyer, hey, you can buy the house, but we can't close until July 8th. So in that scenario, you could easily be compliant with that rule and not put your lender at risk. Because, of course, if you do pay the loan off early and essentially, you know, penalize your lender's probably not going to do any more loans for you, at least no more flip loans. So it's just something that investors should know going into these, because the loan officer is going to tell them anyway. But it is a rule that we have to comply with, because if we don't comply with it, then we're doing the loan for free, and we obviously can't do that and stay in business.
Well, I have another question concerning rent with an option to buy. So you can, a person, an investor can maybe lease out the property and then say, I mean, and I think that's a good opportunity for people who are trying to, they may not be quite ready, they might need another year or so to prepare to purchase. So would be an opportunity, you know, for an investor to take advantage of if they didn't necessarily, if they want to flip it, and they know they want to flip it, but they want to definitely make sure, of course, that they are following the guidelines. At least 210 days they have to have that tenant in place, so you might as well say a year. You're leasing with an option to buy, with the person with the option to buy.
As long as they don't pay the mortgage off in less than 210 days, they can do whatever they want. I mean, it's you know, we don't want to dictate what the investor does. I mean, it's their property to buy and renovate and do what they want to do with. But these are not designed to be short-term loans. I mean, they are mortgages, typically 30-year mortgages. And I don't want to discourage investors from calling and doing loans, but they do need to be aware of that. I would be remiss if I did not say I would be remiss, and any other lender they talk to would be remiss if they didn't share that information, because it's important.
Well, that definitely is great information. So these loans are more so geared towards holding the property.
I mean, not that flipping is not out of the question. They can buy and renovate and flip. They just need to keep the property for basically a little over 6 months, which is, again, not, in most cases, not going to be difficult to do. It would have to be like a really small renovation for them to be able to really flip it, do the work, and turn it around that quickly. And if they're going to turn around that quickly, I would just suggest that, you know, they do a hard money loan, or they just pay cash for it, or whatever they want to do.
Okay, and that was what I was going to mention. That's why those other types of loans are available, too, because it's going to be a quick turnaround. Okay.
Correct, yeah.
Well, we have covered a lot of information, and we have quite a few more questions for you, Richard. So, although this might not be specifically related to a renovation loan, but when a person is going into and they're going into a situation where they're saying, okay, I'm definitely going to purchase more than one property as far as investment properties, do you recommend, or is it advisable from what you see to set up an LLC for your first investment property, or do you have any insight that you can share with us concerning that?
I am so glad you brought that up, and I did not even think of that earlier, and I should have. all of your secondary market lenders, your Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac lenders, and let me just elaborate on that just a little bit for the audience. So secondary market lenders are most of the mortgage companies in the country are secondary market lenders. We're all kind of dipping from the same well. We're getting our money from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or Ginnie Mae. Fannie Mae is conventional lending. Freddie Mac is conventional lending. And Ginnie Mae is all the government lending, FHA, VA, and USDA. So basically mortgages and have you all seen the movie The Big Short?
Long time ago.
Okay. Well, it's a movie. I think it's required viewing for all Americans, in my opinion, because it expands on what I'm talking about right now, and of course goes into why we got into a mortgage crisis in the first place. But anyway, so you know, I refer in the blanket term is secondary market lending, meaning that that's where we're getting our money to lend borrowers is from the secondary market. And then that money is repackaged and sold in the form of bonds. Other types of lending would be, you know, bank or portfolio lending, where lenders literally lend their own money and they are the lender. That loan is not sold in the secondary market. It is held, quote-unquote, in-house. I think it's important for the audience to know those differences, because if they're shopping for financing, they want to know, you know, okay, where can I get a mortgage? So I can get a mortgage from a secondary market lender who does homes on regular move-in condition homes, homes that need renovation, or I can go to a bank and get a house probably on a move-in condition home. Banks would be more likely to do construction loans, portfolio construction loans, and then you've got hard money lenders, and then maybe even seller held financing where the owner holds a mortgage. So those are all possible options for your investor audience. But secondary market lenders like me, we do not lend to LLCs. We only lend to people. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because I know that a lot of people that, you know, they go to investment seminars and so on and so forth, they're often told, yeah, you want to set up an LLC. And there are certain tax reasons and liability reasons that make setting up an LLC an attractive option, but it's certainly not absolutely necessary. It's really up to the individual investor. But I think it's also key, depending on how many properties they're going to own. If they're a one-time investor or they're buying, renovating, and flipping, I don't see much value in setting up an LLC. And I could be totally wrong about that, but one of the key reasons to set up an LLC is to create a barrier, a liability barrier, so that if, you know, a tenant, you know, falls down the stairs, they can't sue you for, you know, a huge amount of money. But if you're going to buy it, renovate it, and flip it, you're never going to have a tenant.
Right, and it's short-term, as you mentioned. Yeah.
And it's short-term. So yeah, that's a really important thing for your audience to think about, is do they want to do the loan in their own name or an LLC? And if they absolutely insist on doing it in an LLC, they can't use a secondary market lender. That cuts that option out. So I'm really glad you brought that up.
Yeah, that is great information. What about when you're thinking about investing with multiple partners?
I've done mortgages for investors where there have been three different borrowers all on the loan. And that means we've got to get three pay stubs, three tax returns, three bank statements. You know, we got to get three of everything. And it's a lot of work, but it's, you know, it is what it is. And we do what we can to accommodate the borrower. So, yeah, I've done that where, you know, like three, you know, friends want to go in and buy an investment property together, whether they're going to rent it or flip it, doesn't matter. So, yeah, that's fine. I think our database or our LOS system, the software we use for applications, will accommodate, I think, up to six borrowers on a loan.
If one plan on living in the property and the other, say if it is three, and one of the borrowers is planning to live in the property, would they still be eligible for the FHA 203K?
Yeah, because you have an owner occupant now. But that's another great question, because now you're talking about a non-occupant co-borrower situation, and for a true non-occupant co-borrower to be eligible, or for the buyer to use the occupant to use that person, they really should be related. So if they're just friends, that may not be an option.
Okay. All right. Well, I do have another question, and Richard, and anyone else, please feel free. While we still have Richard, we have a little bit more time, but we're actually over our time, but maybe we can squeeze in a question from a listener. But when it comes to that debt-to-income ratio, now you want to accumulate and you're purchasing properties, do you actually count the equity of the say for instance, you have now about three investment properties, a primary residence, and three investment properties, and now you have equity in all of your properties, but now you're also factoring in a debt-to-income ratio. How do you look at something like that?
Yeah, so for the subject, let's say that, can you hear me?
Richard?
Yeah, I'm here.
Well, it looks like we may have lost Richard. We'll try to see if we can get Richard back.
I can hear you.
Back.
Okay.
Oh,
I can hear you.
We hear you now. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. I didn't touch the phone or anything. I don't know what happened. It must have been one of those cellular holes or something. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Yes. Did you hear the question?
Yeah. So as far as qualifying on multiple properties and how that affects the qualifying ratios. So first of all, let me explain what a qualifying ratio is just in case people don't know. Qualifying ratios are a basic tenet of lending, and it's nothing more than a percentage of your income. So let's say you make $4,000 a month, gross monthly income, and your mortgage payment is going to be $1,000 a month. 1,000 divided into 4,000 is equal to 25%. So you would have a 25% housing ratio. And there are guidelines. The guidelines really shouldn't be above, depending on the loan program and credit score and all that. The guideline for conventional is your housing ratio shouldn't be above 28%. And for FHA, it shouldn't be above 31%. However, I've gotten loans approved with much, much higher ratios. In other words, if the loan is really strong in a lot of other categories, we can exceed those ratios by several percentage points. So as far as how the other properties are counted against ratios, really, really good question, because you don't want to disqualify yourself as an investor. So let's say you're buying a property, the subject property, the one we're doing the loan on right now, we're going to use 75% of projected rental income on that property. And that helps you qualify for that mortgage, and that's fine, and that's pretty simple. But let's say you own two other rental properties. What lenders will do is they won't look at your lease necessarily. They'll look at your tax returns. And let's say you've owned those properties for 4 years. So again, they're going to look at the last 2 years' tax returns in most cases, sometimes 1 year, but usually two. And they're going to look at how much income you claimed or how much loss you claimed on those properties. So let's say you made $10,000 a year on property A, but you had $12,000 that year in losses. So the net on the tax return is a $2,000 loss. So instead of counting that as income, which is going to lower your qualifying, your income ability to borrow more money, we're going to count that $2,000 loss, and we're going to divide it by 12 months, and we're going to count that as a debt. So that's going to lessen your qualifying ability. And let's say on the second property, you made $15,000 in income, and after expenses, it was a wash. There was zero. No gains, no loss. It was enough expenses to eat up all of that rental income. At least there's no income, but at least there's no loss. So that debt would just be, that would wash itself. So what's the message here? The message is, if you want to keep buying more properties, be mindful of what you're writing off. If you legitimately have lots of expenses on that property, there were a lot of repairs in that year, there was a big theft, there was a big insurance claim, you know, whatever, and there's a perfectly legitimate reason to write off, you know, expenses and lower your taxable income, by all means, you got to do what you got to do. But if it's going to hit you with such a huge loss that it disqualifies you from buying another property, you in effect have just kind of shot yourself in the foot. So again, be mindful, be surgical about what you're writing off if you're planning on buying more property, because you want to keep your qualifying ability strong and in the positive.
Everybody, do you see why you tuned in today? Wow. I mean, this information it's food. It's financial food. I mean, it's great. I mean, if you have an opportunity to position yourself to a point where you ever want to invest in real estate, then there are just certain things that you're going to have to know. And just the information that Richard has shared with us in this little over an hour is just, I mean, it's invaluable. It's invaluable and it's invaluable. So, Richard, can you please share with our listeners how they can get in contact with you? Because I know that after hearing this show, those who are interested in, you know, getting an investment, a renovation loan, whether they're an investor or whether they're a first-time home buyer, I know they're going to want to contact you. How can they reach you?
Sure. Again, my renovation website that is just information about renovation in general, renovation loans in general, is fixandfinance.com. So that's F-I-X-A-N-D, finance, all one word, .com. My phone number is 804-855-4421, and I am available by phone 7 days a week. You can call me at 9:30 on a Sunday night, and I'll probably answer the phone. If I don't, leave a message. I will call you back. And then my email address is rday@assurancemortgage.com. So that's my first initial, R, D-A-Y, my last name, rday@assurancemortgage.com. And I would welcome any calls or inquiries, and I'm happy to help any way I can.
So if somebody just has a question, I mean, they just, they don't know where to go. They heard the show and they thought of a question that we didn't think of. They can give you a call?
Absolutely. Give me a call, shoot me an email, whatever's easiest or more convenient.
Yvette, what do you think about this?
Just thank you so much for sharing this information again. We are continually learning.
Yep.
And this is what you do. This is your specialty, and you've been doing this for years. And this information has been out there, but sometimes you don't think about it because you don't know. So that's why we're trying to provide this information to, our audience, to our listeners. And please share this information with others. Post it. The show is going to be archived about an hour after it ends, and I would encourage the listeners to share the information with others, family, friends,
yep.
and different, people that you think would benefit from this information, because just like I mentioned about grants and different other opportunities that's available for us to take advantage of, sometimes because we don't know, we can't use that information that could actually help us. And especially some of the things that Richard shared with us today is definitely a great way to kind of get in the door and to begin building and creating wealth through real estate investing. So, Richard, again, thank you so much. We have to have you come back again. I know you have a lot more information that you can share with us on various, topics that we've already talked about. We definitely we're planning to have you back, and just thank you again.
Any parting words for our listeners tonight, Richard?
No. I mean, the market is hot, and there's always opportunity. And I really just would second what you just said, Yvette. Learn. I think knowledge is power. And work with people that know what they're doing, and be smart about your purchasing and your renovation plans. And we're all here to help. And thank you all very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Great show.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. We don't take you for granted. You could be doing anything, but you're taking time out to spend it with myself and Yvette, my favorite co-host.
Absolutely.
So, again, I want to thank you so much for your time, Yvette.
Yes, thank you so much for tuning in. And remember, follow us. You can follow us on Blog Talk. We have some great shows coming up. We're going to share on just various topics, whether it's real estate investing, just career in real estate. It's just a lot of things that's going to be available. So, go back, check out some of our past shows, share with others, and follow us. And so you can stay updated concerning what's going on in the real estate market today.
Whatever you do, give Richard a call. Richard Day.
Absolutely.
Assurance Financial. I mean, because you learned a lot just from listening to this show. And you can tell by the information that was shared that if there's something that you don't know about home renovation loans, you know who to call now, okay? If somebody, this information didn't come across your ears for no reason at all, it's either for you or it's for somebody that you know. So if it's not for you, then it's for somebody that you know, or else you wouldn't have gotten it, right? So make sure you give them a call. Again, make sure you don't forget to tune in next week. I mean, we have got shows lined up that are really, if you're interested in real estate and you're interested in investing, I mean, we've got shows that are going to help you to achieve your goals. So, again, we don't take you for granted. Thank you so much for your time. My name is Juwanza.
And I am Yvette. We appreciate you, and thank you for your support.
See you next week.
Bye-bye.